Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Donald Trump's G20 boycott. What does it mean for South Africa's leadership role? The South African Reserve Bank's exchange control shakeup, a bold reform or a risk to investor confidence? Why customer expectations are skyrocketing and how companies need to adapt fast? And a global call for peace, the Desmond Tutu Foundation turns reflection into collective action. It's Monday, the 10th of November. South Africa's role in global governance is once again under pressure after Donald Trump insisting the country should not be in the G20, in fact pulling out all US representation. I want to discuss the geopolitical significance and maybe what this moment tells us about Africa's standing in a fast-shifting global order. Joining me is Professor Richard Calland, University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership's Africa Program. Richard, a very warm welcome. How big a blow, in your opinion, to South Africa's aspirations and the success of this G20 is the move from Washington?
Well, on the one hand, it's absolutely right to say that the G20 depends on its political legitimacy, and that in turn depends on sufficient support and consensus in decision making from the members, the 19 countries and the two multilateral bodies, the EU and the AU. So when one leaves or boycotts, and when that one that does that is a major power, then obviously it's a blow to the legitimacy of the process. But on the other hand, this is increasingly, I think it's fair to say, rogue actor, in the sense that the President of the United States behaves in a way that is hard to follow, is often irrational. And when the decision is announced by him on the basis of what is obviously, patently obviously, false information, disinformation, as it is in this case, then it's hard really to add much credibility to that. And the show can go on because the G20 can continue to make decisions. It's not a body that has such tight rules. It's not a treaty organization as other multilateral bodies are. And so it depends on the consensus of those who show up. And so the remaining countries, those that do show up and are part of the leadership summit, can reach decisions without him. And in fact, ironically, it may be easier for them to reach agreement without him, because if he was there objecting and making a big fuss, then they wouldn't be able to issue a communique, which is the ultimate goal with these things. And he would have to actively object from a distance, which would be a peculiar thing to do, I think.
But can the show go on even if a communique is issued with real meaning and impact, or is it all going to be watered down?
Well, I think it won't be watered down. I think, if anything, it's going to be watered up, if that's an expression, because with him present, there would be much more likelihood of compromise. There would have to be a watering down in order to tolerate or to accommodate, I should say, his or the United States positions. If he's absent, then in fact, and there's sufficient consensus amongst the other countries, particularly the middle powers and particularly the kind of BRICS bloc present there, then in fact it may be that this G20 can go further, and that it can take the multitude of the plethora of recommendations that have emerged during the course of numerous working groups and task forces and other processes that funnel into this final furlong of the G20 process, that more of those will make their way through into the final communique.
How do you think South Africa should now be responding? Richard, we've reached out to the presidency, and the reply that we got, and I quote, "Frankly, it's not an issue for us to dedicate time for." What's our next move, do you think?
I understand that, and I think that South Africa has played a straight bat throughout this year. It's tried to do what any presidency of a process like the G20 should do, which is behave with dignity, to behave in an inclusive fashion, to be as professional as possible. That's what diplomacy requires, dialogue. And I don't think South Africa and its presidency can be faulted for its diplomatic efforts this year. It's done everything it can within reason. But it's dealing with an unreasonable, at times irrational, political actor. And so there's only so far you can go with such an actor. And if at the last moment that President Trump throws his toys out of the pram, as he's done on this issue, then there's nothing more to be done. And I think South Africa should quite rightly focus now on running a good summit and to make sure that the G20, with those present that are present, is as successful as possible.
So to extend your metaphor then, we've been playing with a straight bat, but we've also got to score some runs during the course of this event. How do we get easy runs onto the board then?
Well, it's interesting. Even with the United States present, there have been some accomplishments this year, including in particular in June, the Ministers of Finance meeting in Durban, where a consensus was reached on important issues around debt, financial stability around the world, cost of capital, and various other issues that are important to the world, but particularly important to emerging market economies, and particularly Africa. And of course, this is the first African G20, and a lot is being made of that. And it's important that there are obvious, clear victories for the Global South and for this continent. And that's what I think South Africa will be wanting to put by way of runs on the board, to be able to demonstrate that this is a G20 that has delivered commitments and action-orientated recommendations across a range of issues that are important for economic development on this continent.
Do you think this episode then strengthens or weakens Africa's collective voice?
Potentially strengthens if the line can be held, if the recommendations, and I haven't been able to focus on all of them, but the ones I've seen and the ones through the B20 process that I followed closely are largely progressive. The voice of the Global South, the voice of emerging market economies has definitely been heard. And South Africa, I think, has done a good job at organizing process to enable those voices to be heard, new ideas to emerge, and to carry on this three-year period of Global South G20s, starting 2 years ago with India, then Brazil, and now South Africa. And that three-year period, I think, is an important period in the G20's history. Important decisions have been made. And the most recent new entry to this kind of body of work comes in the form of the Inequality Commission that Professor Stiglitz chaired on behalf of the G20, commissioned in effect by President Ramaphosa. And that's a new addition, and it's ambitious because it invites the global community to say that there should be an international level panel that communicates data and ideas on how to tackle inequality between and within countries in the same way that the IPCC does on climate science.
Just a quick one in conclusion. Now that the United States is no longer involved, how do blocs like China and Europe step up?
Well, I think it's I would distinguish the two in many ways. And what I've said on this subject and written in the past is the role of middle powers. And I think you and I spoke about
that
on a previous occasion. And the role of middle powers, and I'm talking here about countries that are relatively small economies but influential nonetheless, like Spain, although Spain is not actually a G20 member, but it's attached as a permanent guest member of the G20. But countries also like Germany, which is not a great power but with significant power, and then of course the BRICS countries, Brazil, South Africa, and to some extent China. But China, of course, is also now emerging as a great power. So I think it's the relationship between those middle powers and the other great powers, their ability to forge consensus, which transcends Global South, Global North interests, developed and developing world interests. And that, after all, I think is the most important aspect of the G20. It's that one club where significant players, economic players from both Global North and Global South come together. It's the potential buckle in the world order. And if it can get it right and produce consensus on the key issues, that's a really significant thing.
Richard Calland, always appreciate the insight and analysis. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Our big changes at the South African Reserve Bank are sparking a degree of alarm in financial circles. Now, the bank has quietly tightened exchange control rules for non-residents. That's a move that could, as I understand it, make it harder, maybe even slower and more expensive for foreign investors to access their South African income. The Institute for International Tax and Finance calls it an own goal, warning it could deter investment, reduce liquidity on the JSE, and even undermine confidence in just the months after South Africa has been taken off the Financial Action Task Force grey list. Well, let's explore this in a little more detail. Michael Kranstorff is with me, director at the Institute. Michael, thank you very much indeed. Let's start with the basics. What exactly has the Reserve Bank changed, and why, in your opinion, is the timing raising such concern?
Thanks for having me on the show, Jeremy. The Reserve Bank has basically tightened exchange control for non-residents. Historically, non-residents didn't require to obtain a tax clearance certificate from SARS in order to send income that they generated in South Africa abroad. That was a special exemption that non-residents were given. But last week, without warning, the Reserve Bank changed that and instituted the requirement that non-residents now need to apply to SARS for a tax clearance certificate to remit quite a lot of different categories of income, not all, weirdly, but just dividends, for example, rental income, directors' fees. Mm. These are the categories of income that non-residents now require to apply to SARS for a tax clearance certificate in order to send those funds abroad.
And done by stealth, it seems. Do we know why?
No, we don't. In fact, over the last few years, there's been a relaxation of exchange controls. So why they would, tighten up and particularly targeting non-residents doesn't really make much sense. These are people, many of them that have already left South Africa, but still retain assets in the country. And, after this, people are going to sell their properties that they're renting out or their South African shares and say, I'd much rather have my money abroad where I can access income from it whenever I want to.
You've called this an own goal. What exactly do you mean by that? And I guess I've got to ask how well it would seem to be a well-intentioned regulatory tweak could end up hurting investor confidence instead of maybe strengthening it.
Putting obstacles in the way of investors to access their income from South African source investments deters investment. Why would you put your money in South Africa, in the South African Stock Exchange as a non-resident, if you have to wait a month and apply to SARS for permission to get your dividends out of the country? There's many other emerging markets with attractive returns, and you'd much rather invest in those exchanges. So hurting non-residents with increased compliance and burdensome tax clearance certificates deters investment and doesn't make South Africa an attractive investment destination. It's crazy at this time. We've worked so hard over the last 2 years to get off the FATCA grey list and improve the climate in South Africa in terms of the financial services industry and make it attractive for foreign investment. And now you sort of throw sand in their eyes and make it difficult for them to invest here.
And Michael, one of your sharper criticisms is around inconsistency. Why does that matter so much in practice?
The problem is that certain categories of income now require this tax clearance certificate and others don't. Dividends do, interest doesn't. Individual investors abroad won't know this. They have to consult with tax practitioners like myself to know when they need an ART, when they don't. And the banks, the exchange control departments of the banks, it adds complexity to their job, having to know when tax clearance is required to remit funds and when it's not. The banks are already struggling with the current simpler legislation. To get money out of South Africa for non-residents is already a challenge. And this is only going to complicate their task more and make it more difficult. And this inconsistency just makes no sense. It just adds complexity for no reason.
Have you started to put numbers around how this move could impact maybe market liquidity and sentiment?
We know that historically that foreign investors were quite large on the JSE. Before COVID, there were almost 50% of the JSE was actually owned by foreign investors. That's declined markedly over the last few years. Estimates range between now 30% and some even as low as in the 20s. And, moves like this are only going to make that worse. And South Africa desperately needs foreign capital to grow. And moves like this just discourage that and push foreign investors away.
So you're urging the bank then to review the policy and introduce a de minimis threshold for small transactions. In your opinion, then, what would a sensible investor-friendly fix look like?
Yeah, I would reverse the decision and go back to not requiring a tax clearance certificate for income generated by non-residents in South Africa. But even then, I would, not residents are entitled to a what's called a single discretionary allowance, where you can take R1 million out of South Africa without requiring tax clearance to do so. But non-residents aren't afforded that same opportunity. And if just introducing that would make the life of so many non-residents much easier, if they could take R1 million out of South Africa without requiring tax clearance, that would really already improve the situation and reduce the compliance burden.
Thank you very much for talking to me today, Michael Krantsdorf, Director at the Institute for International Tax and Finance. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I think it's fair to say that businesses can no longer rely on brand loyalty or routine marketing these days to stay relevant. Today's consumers are expecting hyper-personalized experiences, this whole notion of emotional connection, as well as technology that is frictionless, and all of this at the same time. So as creativity and artificial intelligence converge, the very definition of customer engagement is being rewritten. Accenture Song's Global Chief Executive Officer Ndidi Ote is here in Johannesburg for an event called Accenture Fest 2025. It's where leaders, I understand, are exploring how creativity, data and design thinking are reshaping the customer journey. Ndidi, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe just let's start with the broad canvas, if we can. In your view, how fundamentally then is the relationship between businesses and customers changing right now that is necessitating all of this change?
You know, I will share with you, in some ways, everything is changing, and at the core, it's still the same. It has always been that we are supposed to start with the customer. That is where we have always been. The reality is our operating models, our structures, our technology, previously it was all siloed. You would have different ownership across the board for any customer experience. So you would have a sales department. You might have a stores department or a field department. You might have a marketing department. You might have a data and insights department. You might have a separate digital department, a different commerce department. And all of a sudden, there were all these different almost kingdoms that weren't coming together to actually create one experience. We always tried, but we've never actually been able to execute it. And part of that is because of technology. There are limitations to seeing one connected view of a customer ID. There are limitations of actually saying, I can actually build an offline to online to back to an offline experience for my customer, a truly harmonized connected journey. That used to be really difficult to do. Now AI has helped to break down some of those silos to actually make it easier. Oftentimes when we're talking to some of our key ecosystem partners, you look at the platform that they're willing to provide customers and you start to ask, is this a customer service platform? Mm. Is this a marketing platform? Is this a commerce platform? And I will tell you, it is all of the above. That is fundamentally different today, a capability that we did not used to have. However, it has always been about the customer first.
You make a very compelling case, and I absolutely acknowledge that AI is now able to personalize at scale. But the problem is companies keeping the human element alive in that customer relationship. And that's a huge risk, isn't it?
It's a risk if you're not actually focused on the customer. I actually believe the human part of us is what makes us special and is what it's what differentiates brands, you know, or else we're all the same. One thing I always say is AI can automate tasks. It will not automate imagination, purpose, authenticity. That is something that comes that is specific to your brand, specific to your people, and very specific to understanding how do you provide your customer with even more. You know, what AI provides today, it is going to help completely transform how we do the work. So if we think about our work is going to change, That is critical. And that is something that means that the steps that we're used to taking, obsessing over that campaign iteration in XYZ country or XYZ language, you don't have to do that anymore. Because actually, there are capabilities and tools that can actually do that for you. But what you're still going to have to do is you're going to have to determine, how do you really make yourself special? How do you make sure that your creativity is excellent? Because good is not going to be good enough anymore. And that is significantly different. That is the work changing. The second component that absolutely is going to change, that is about humans, is our workforce, is our talent. It is going to be about, how do we think about evolving our talent? Who are the different types of people you need to hire? What are the new skills that you need them to accept? How do you make sure that you're actually operating in a space where, do you know what? In the past year, we have had new capabilities, specifically being driven by AI, than we've ever had before. You need to make sure that you have a workforce of talent that knows how to adapt and adjust and is ready for what's next as they're continuing to protect and drive the business forward. That is a change and an evolution of your workforce. And then the final thing is, you have to make sure that you have the digital assets for your teams actually to do the work. You know, they have to have a workbench to get their work done. It's funny, because sometimes what we do is we say, change the way you do your work, change the work. Then we say, do you know what? I'm going to get different talent. I'm going to evolve. I'm going to upskill them. But then we never gave them the technology to actually execute what we wanted them to do. So that doesn't allow them to work well either. So it's much more complex than just saying, hey, AI's here, let's go. Doing it at scale is always a human conversation.
So if creativity meeting technology then is a recurring theme, I wonder what that intersection actually looks like in practice for a brand.
So, you know, the first thing I will say, and something that we say often in song, is creativity has always needed technology and technology has always needed creativity. So sometimes I think we set things up as friction points or polar opposites, when there's always been really good tension and really good integration when you think about creativity and technology. When you actually say, you know, Steve Jobs said something specifically around design, and it was specifically saying, design isn't just simply about how something looks, it's about how something works. And so when you think about creativity, I think about creativity through the lens. Creativity is also about how something works. It's about how something feels. It's about how something is human and how you're going to interact with that thing. And so when you think about it through that way, any technology, what's really interesting is, you think about technology, and we always talk about in tech, you know, I have to do user testing. I have to make sure that the technology could functionally work, but you might not, it might be cumbersome. You might say, hey, this user interface, I'd rather choose a different one. If you actually think about the tech that you use today, I guarantee you one of your deciding factors is it friendly to use? Does it feel natural? Is it something that feels like very human in how I use it? Technology has to be human, because that is what differentiates it. So I actually believe creativity and technology have always been really close cousins. And how we continue to work together is going to be what differentiates brands.
Didi Ote, thank you very much indeed. Accenture Song's Global Chief Executive Officer. I do appreciate the time and the insight.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program today, in a world marked by increasing conflict, division and uncertainty, the Desmond and Lea Tutu Legacy Foundation is calling on us to take what it says is a small but powerful step. What is that? Well, to write a letter of peace. The campaign, launched ahead of the 15th Desmond Tutu International Peace Lecture, inviting people from South Africa and I guess around the world to share what peace means to them. Joining us now from the foundation, the Chief Executive Officer, Janet Jobson, a very warm welcome to you. Let me suggest cynically to you that peace campaigns often risk becoming feel-good exercises. How are you going to ensure this one drives genuine civic engagement rather than just some passive virtue signaling?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. Although I think often in our work, we miss the depth of the opportunity that hope presents. I think often we think of hope as just feel-good optimism, but hope fuels action. And so for us, building a collective voice of people mobilizing for peace, of people navigating very complex, violent situations, that really matters, even in a small way. And what we saw with Desmond Tutu's activism for so many years was the power that one step can take to inspire the next step. I think of, you know, for instance, the Dunnes Stores strikes in Ireland. One person refusing to handle South African grapefruit turns into a movement, and that movement then becomes something that, you know, Nelson Mandela says inspires him while he's sitting on Robben Island. So we never know where inspiration's going to come from. And I think particularly in dark times, I think we're in very, very difficult times at the moment, recommitting to peace, recommitting to hope can actually be an act of revolution.
What's the hard truth that you want us to confront about our own contribution to division and conflict?
I think it's really, really important that we all understand that, you know, our shared humanity means that if we dehumanize anyone, we're all dehumanized. That's really what the Arch used to speak about when he spoke about Ubuntu. And so what we see around the world and we see in our own country is that, you know, these drives for division, you know, we've seen today the announcement that the US vice president isn't coming to the G20 because of the so-called white genocide. These drives for division actually undermine our human flourishing because they dismiss the opportunity to connect as human beings. And what we're really trying to do with the Peace Lecture and all the platforms that we work with is to do what we call the very hard work of keeping on trying to find each other across divides, because it's in that keeping on trying to find each other that real change can happen.
As difficult and as exasperating as that can be at times.
Absolutely. It's not easy work.
The Archbishop also believed, Janet, that peace requires justice, and we have huge justice gaps, not only in South Africa, but around the world today. Critical that the campaign talks to that particular issue. How are you doing that?
Yeah, I think that is, you know, really critical, and it's interesting to be talking to you as the hearings into the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's failure to act on prosecutions is happening, because I think there's this deep pain in South Africa that we didn't get justice for the crimes of apartheid, and we're only now, you know, here we are 30 years into democracy, only now busy investigating why that was. Justice is really, really fundamental, because if we're going to heal societies, we need to repair what is unjust and what is unequal. And I really hope that platforms like the G20, where South Africa's put a flag in the ground to say inequality is one of the issues we're going to work on, they really give us the opportunity to build a collective voice. And for us, it's important that people's voices are heard, not just politicians, but that we really commit as a whole society towards justice and taking every step we can in whatever sphere of influence we have.
And it's all people's voices, and it's difficult surely to bring young people into the conversation in a way that feels authentic and maybe not like a top-down appeal from an institution.
Yeah, you know, we've had such a wonderful experience working with young people here at the foundation. And recently we held a public speaking competition with the Western Cape Education Department, where, you know, we had young people, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, talking about their responsibility to transform their communities. And the glint in their eye, the sense of power and possibility that they had when they were given the opportunity to matter, to really count in society, for their voices to matter, was really, really powerful. We're happy that we're continuing that partnership and that we're going to be profiling some of those young people's voices at the Peace Lecture this year. But I think the opportunity to give young people a sense that they matter in a society, particularly in which there is so much youth unemployment, in which there's so little opportunity for young people, I think is actually quite profound.
And at the end of this campaign, is there a singular message that you would like the world to see? Not something that's idealistic, but something that's really honest.
I think we really want people to bed down the idea that peace starts with you. You know, we know in South Africa the violence of our communities. In the Birth to 20 study, which followed a cohort of children from birth through their lives, By the age of 18, 99% of the children had been exposed to violence in their home or community. So violence is not far away from us as South Africans. We see it in road rage. We see it in drunken brawls at shebeens. We've got to take a step, every single one of us, to build peace into our own lives and to build it into our communities. And that's hard work. That's not just mere optimism. That's really, you know, pulling up your sleeves, digging in, and making the world a more peaceful place every single day.
And that's very, very difficult in this digital world full of angry, polarized voices. It is hard to counter cynicism and convince people that a small act of expression actually matters.
Absolutely, which is why we want to get this campaign really going globally and within South Africa, really changing the narrative a little bit, really hearing voices of hope, hearing that cynicism isn't the easy option, actually, that cynicism shouldn't be what we reach for, that we should be reaching for hope, gritty, real, hard hope that can really help fuel action to drive change.
Janet Jobson, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of the Desmond and Leah Tutu Legacy Foundation. I do appreciate your time. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.